Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, the last week of the year, we're looking back on some favorite interviews of 2014. We'll hear from restaurateur Ed Rudisill about making connections via social media. We'll also talk with Tina Jessen of Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen in Carmel, and with Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop in Broad Ripple. We'll check in with Nick Mink and Marsh Skeel of Sitka Salmon Shares. Plus, we'll be in the kitchen with two local chefs, Tony Hanslitz of the Chef's Academy and Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market, and Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. Well, here we are at the end of 2014, and it's the time for year-in-review essays. Nouveau News Weekly asked me to take a look back at the year in food and restaurants and bars and that sort of thing. So here is what I came up with. If 2014 were a person, it would have been living in Fountain Square, but wishing I had taken that apartment in Fletcher Place instead. It would have just picked up produce from the farmer's market along with fresh artisanal bread, on which it would spread jam made from local fruit, of course. Or maybe it would just go out for brunch. It would have Fernet in its liquor cabinet and a growler of coconut stout in the fridge. It would be eating ramen or poutine and bacon-topped donuts, in which case it would be drinking cold-brewed coffee or maybe breakfast magpie. And it would be congratulating itself on already scoring tickets to the next Chef's Night Off dinner. In other words, there was definitely a local food and drink focus in 2014. All in all, it was a very good year. For one thing, the restaurants and bars just kept opening. Thunderbird, the Mass Ave Pizzology, Plow and Anchor, Georgia Reese's, North Inn, Public Greens. It's been fun to see dishes like poutine, long a favorite at 20 Tab, and at Chef Ryan Nelson's Late Harvest Kitchen, show up on menus from Broad Ripple's 317 Burger to Greenwood's new Reverie Restaurant to the concession stands of Bankers Life Fieldhouse. And we all seem to be getting in touch with our down-home roots and enjoying a little southern fried goodness as well, whether at Thunderbird, where Chef de Cuisine Andrew Whitmoyer is rocking out fried chicken, shrimp and grits, boiled peanuts, and collard greens, or at Georgia Reese's Southern Table and Bar, which opened near the pyramids and will be launching a downtown location as well. But it's not all fried chicken and collards. Barbecue, whether Texas, Carolina, or Kansas City style, has been a big hit on the north side since the North End Barbecue and Moonshine opened in the Nora Plaza. And who would have thought that the restaurant's signature moonshine punch would go over so well in Nora? But 2014 was also the year that Indianapolis got its first vegetarian restaurant, and then soon gained another one. Ezra's Enlightened Cafe debuted in Broad Ripple with a mostly raw and vegan menu, and then Three Carrots opened in the Indianapolis City Market, providing a much-needed veg option for the downtown lunchtime landmark, which continues to gain momentum with a growing lineup of events, including what has become a new holiday tradition, the 12 Chefs of Christmas Food and Brew Extravaganza with Flat 12. And even though it's not really a vegetarian restaurant, the new Public Greens in Broad Ripple from Patashew Inc.'s Martha Hoover is definitely veg-friendly, although it's making news for its mission to donate all profits to the Patashew Foundation, which feeds hungry kids after school. But not all of this year's news-making restaurants were actually restaurants. 2014 was definitely the year of the pop-up in Indianapolis. Chef's Night Off, a dinner series run by local restaurant scene veteran R.J. Wall and Thunderbird's Whitmoyer, has featured a changing roster of young cooks, from established names such as Carlos Salazar and Jonathan Brooks to promising line cooks and even a few out-of-town chefs. And speaking of Brooks, the 30-year-old opened his much-anticipated Milktooth restaurant in Fletcher Place, providing breakfast and brunch fans with a creative menu, day-drinking cocktails, and coffee from B Coffee Roasters. Coffee, too, continues to make headway as part of the city's culinary scene, with more and more roasters opening, including an outpost of Louisville's Quills Coffee that just set up shop in the 9 on Canal building. It's no surprise that Indy hosted its second caffeine crawl this year. Cold brewed coffee is making inroads, whether in bottles at General American Donut Company or brewed at Hoover's new Public Greens. Breweries continued to open at a breakneck pace in 2014. Chili Water opened in Fletcher Place, Two Deep began brewing downtown, and others opened around the area, including Scarlet Lane Brewing Company, which launched in McCordsville and quickly gained a following with that coconut stout. The craft cocktail scene showed no signs of slowing down either. In fact, you can expect plenty more distilleries to join Hotel Tango, which now makes whiskey, vodka, rum, gin, and moonshine in its Fletcher Place distillery. And the local chapter of the United States Bartenders Guild keeps growing, and local bartenders such as Joshua Gonzalez, Jessica Taylor, Ryan Puckett, and others keep advancing in national competitions. And the newly formed Indiana Craft Beverage Association will be launching a cocktail week next year. So 2015 just might be even better than 2014. Well, I mention a lot here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio that you can find more information on many of our local restaurants and businesses on Facebook. Well, restaurateur Ed Rudisill has made great use of such social media outlets as Facebook to make plenty of his own connections as well.
Well, I think I'm relatively outgoing, depending on my day. You know, sometimes I can't say relatively. I know I'm very outgoing. But, you know, whenever I go out of town, I try to, like, locate usually, like, one good place to as a jumping off point. And then if I really love the place, I'll ask the bartenders and servers where else do I need to go in town. But almost always in this day of, like, social media, we'll trade either Facebook, Twitter, whatever, and then I try to stay in contact with everybody because it's fun and it's interesting and it makes a revisit to those places really interesting. You know, we were talking earlier about the ramen. You know, I ate at a wonderful ramen joint in D.C. in the spring. It was kind of a last-minute trip. We went there for the cherry blossoms, you know, around the National Mall. Wanted to eat. A lady I know named Wendy Tien, that writes the Upstart Kitchen blog. She's amazing. She is a great writer. I think she's a lawyer for the Justice Department or something. She has some, like, totally non-food-related job. But she had sent me an email and said, "Hey, I saw you're going to be in D.C. We should link up." I'm like, okay, great, let's do that. And then we found out that she wasn't in town for, like, two more days. And it was a quick trip for us. But she gave me a list of places. And so we hit Daikaya. Which they were doing a very different style of ramen, like a Sapporo style. Yeah, I mean, anytime I go into any city, anytime I get chatting with somebody, like, I try to maintain that connection because it's fun and, you know, you've got different perspectives in the industry from depending on what their job function is or what city they're in, and just because every city is so different in the way that the restaurant industry runs. And so, I mean, you know, lately I've been really obsessed with Seattle. But my wife always teases me, like, because everywhere I go,
right,
like, I still stay in contact with literally the very first person I met in Sicily. When we ate at a dinner, we had been in town for 3 hours, went to dinner. The somm at the restaurant was wonderful. She and I got along really well. We still stay in contact. She has since moved to Paris. And so she kind of fills me in on what's going on in Paris and, you know, things like that. But no, we still probably talk on a monthly basis, maybe once a month or so.
Well, now tell me about Michaela Hayes, you know, how you connected with her and got her to Indianapolis for a workshop.
The first time I read about her was in the New York Times when there was an article about Gramercy Tavern and Mike Anthony creating the pickling station for her. And then gave her, I think she had 4 or 5 staff members underneath her, and that's all they did was, like, fermentation, pickling, all that. That was how I got led to her blog. When we were opening Black Market, there were things that we wanted to do. We wanted to, we knew that the pickling program was going to be pretty serious, and at that time I was really interested. I had found her blog, and I was really interested in nukazuke pickling, which is kind of pickling vegetables and rice bran, using that as the medium. So you kind of bury everything in this. It feels like sand. You know, you just kind of bury it, and you create this, like, yeast culture inside, and then pack everything in and just let it ferment. She had a post about it, but it was very brief. And I said, I need to know this lady. Like, what she's doing is amazing. There's only a handful of places that were operating at that level as far as like the fermentation level. And I mean, I reached out to the Culture Pickle Shop as well in Berkeley. I never really heard anything back from them, but Michaela, I left a post or a comment on one of her posts saying I would love to get in contact with Michaela. And she responded via email and, you know, asked what kind of questions I had, and I told her. And then we just kind of started a conversation going back and forth, and like, oh, we're, you know, Micah, Frank, and I are opening a new restaurant in Indianapolis, and, you know, we're really interested in some of these techniques. And we just always had it out there, like, you know, she's just super nice. I believe you met her, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, she was always asking, like, how's it going? How's the build-out going? Whatever. And we just always, again, we would talk about once a month or email back and forth. And after about a year of Black Market being open, we just kind of said, one of these days we should do, an event together, you know?
So these connections that you make through the internet and things you read and different blogs or articles in the paper, it really, you know, it continues to have an effect, you know, on what you're doing here.
Well, I think that the food community is very, well, it's very tight anyway. I mean, it may seem like, how could you possibly know everybody, because there's just, you know, millions of restaurants across the country, but it really is kind of a small community, and everybody, it's the 6 degrees of separation. Somebody knows somebody that knows somebody, and everybody is pretty welcoming. You know, I just can't imagine 30 years ago, like, you know, you... Here's a perfect example. So when we were developing our sour sausage recipe, I am familiar with the way that they make it in northern Thailand. But in northern Thailand, you would take, you know, sausages filled with raw pork, and you would, like, and your ingredients, and you would stuff the sausages and leave them outside for, like, 4 days to ferment. Obviously, we can't do that in the United States. I mean, the health department regulates. I mean, it's just unfathomable. You couldn't do it. But I know of restaurants that have done that, so I reached out to some people that I had been networked with, and some not even so, like, unsolicited email kind of thing. Like, I sent a message over to Andy Ricker at Pock Pock, and I said, I know you serve this on your menu. How do you do it? You know, how do you get around these things? And, like, he responded back to me immediately, and you just couldn't have done that 30 years ago. You would have to, like, handwrite a note, send it off. Maybe in 3 or 4 months you might have gotten a response back. Maybe not. You know, I talked to a couple of the cooks at Next in Chicago, because their second menu they did at Next was a Thai menu. And Chef Dave Barron had sent out some nem sausage and nem prik for us to try. And so I knew that they had done it before as well. And again, through some mutual connections, I know a couple of guys that had worked there. So we actually got the Next recipe. They sent us the recipe of how they did their sausage. Now, we did end up, like, using more in line with the way that, at least ingredient-wise and preparation-wise, with the people that work on our team, you know, from Siam Square that are from that area, employing that, but also on that other side, like, the more modern preparations as far as not hanging it outside, you know, to cure. But, you know, those things work. And so being able to reach out to a network like that, you just couldn't have done that prior to social media.
We've been talking with restaurateur Ed Rudisill of Rook Black Market, Siam Square, and Thunderbird. You can check out his blog, View from the Middle, at edrudisill.com. When Carmel Tea House owner Tina Jessen first moved to Indiana from England, she wasn't sure what she'd do until she started selling her baked goods at farmers markets and people began asking her about tea. She opened Tina's traditional Old English kitchen this past fall, and I stopped in recently to hear about how the business has grown. tell me how this all came about.
Oh, goodness me. Well, I moved out to Indiana from England. I've come from the Derbyshire region of England, and my husband has worked for Rolls-Royce Aero Engines for the last 25 years. And in 2008, he had the opportunity to come out to Indianapolis, and we were just ready for a change, and I thought, why not? And I think he was a bit surprised when he came home, and he said he'd found a really lovely job that he'd like to take. The problem was it was in America. And I went, oh, where? Really excited. And he said, Indianapolis. And I went, where's Indianapolis? And he went, Indy 500. I went, oh, okay. So about a year later, we came out for a visit. That was in the April of 2008. And by August, we were living here. So, it's been... quite a change. And the three things you miss the most when you emigrate to a new country is family, friends, and food. And I'm a bit of a foodie, so I started baking things that we couldn't get hold of quite so easily out here, things like English scones and crumpets and one or two other things, and I started selling through local farmers markets. I was at Traders Point Creamery back in 2011, and then we were at Plainfield and Zionsville, and then people started asking me about tea party catering and would I be interested. I thought, how hard can that be? Tea sandwiches and cups of tea? Yes, we can do that.
Was that anything you had ever done?
It wasn't, because I've never really been in service. I've always been a very passionate home baker. When the kids were small, we used to do a lot of baking. I used to get them in the kitchen and do all those kind of mumsy things that you do. And every Christmas, I would make Christmas cake and mince pies and... you know, do all that kind of stuff that my mum and my gran did with me when I was growing up. But you have to watch the waistline, because when you make a batch of 12, it's amazing, so to be able to do it for other people has been absolutely wonderful. But I do remember when I first came out here, I was thinking, what am I going to do now?
Sure.
Kids have left home. I'm in a new country, need to make friends, need to do something with my life. And... people have always said, do something that is genuine, something that's authentic to you. And I thought, well, I'm English.
Right.
I know how to bake scones and English food. And I'm much a foodie. So that's really what got me started. But I kind of remembered when I was in my late 20s, I'd been to a fantastic tea room in England and thought to myself, well, wouldn't it be lovely to run something like a tea room by the time I'm 50? Didn't think I'd be doing it in America, though, at that time.
That's kind of an interesting twist.
It is. So, when the opportunity came along to do tea parties and do all this lovely baking and sell, and people keep saying to me, oh, Tina, you know, I love your accent, and I never get fed up of people telling me that. I really don't.
That's good. Because it is very charming.
But... a lot of people have said, we don't care what you talk about as long as you're talking. And it's like, okay, so let's pick something I know something about, afternoon tea. So I became a bit of an expert, I suppose, learned a lot more about different types of tea. Because in England, we drink a lot of English breakfast tea, hot with milk, which we never have to describe like that in England, because it's just tea, where here you do, because tea is usually cold over ice with sugar and such. So it's been a learning curve, I think, for both me and for a lot of my guests that I've worked with over the last 3 years. And I've always wanted to run the business through a tea room. But finding the right location, the right kind of foot traffic and the right area has always been challenging, and I must have looked at over 20 properties over the last 2 to 3 years
before
I found this place here in Carmel. And I love it. I mean, we're in a period building. We have a lovely kitchen. We're within walking distance of Main Street. We have parking at the back. I mean, these were all criteria, but to find that in one place at a price I could afford was out of my grasp. And then... Chance would have it, I came across the sweet shop here as they were downsizing their space and the other half of the building becoming available. It was like, this so could work. Okay. And I tried not to get too excited. And we opened in October. So,
yeah, did you know this was the space for you when you first saw it? You said you'd looked at lots of places.
Oh, you have no idea. I was so close to signing a contract with a property over in Zionsville that just was an 8 out of 10. And when I saw this, I just knew this was a 10 out of 10. And if I hadn't have put the work in looking at the previous property, I wouldn't have known how perfect this was when I saw it, which is why I say when I saw it, I didn't want to get too excited because I just knew, but I just didn't want to kind of go, all in one go and scare everybody off. So
now, what were you doing at the time? You have been doing these tea parties and baking and classes and that sort of thing, right?
Absolutely. And like I say, it started off small. I'm a big believer in doing a little bit with what you have. You know, what can you do now with what you have? And I started as a home-based vendor baking from home. But then as soon as I started being asked to do catered work, I had to get fully certified through a commercial kitchen, and I actually worked down in Indy's kitchen down in Indianapolis for a good 6 months or so while I was looking for somewhere a little closer to home, which is actually over in Brownsburg. And then I started partnering with other businesses because I thought, well, I'm looking for a little bit of space and a little bit of time in a kitchen, and maybe there's other restaurants or businesses out there that have a little bit of time and space available, and they would appreciate a little bit of extra rent. So I started looking there, and I worked with Dawson's 2 over in Brownsburg for almost a year. And then I partnered with a little coffee shop out in Danville on the west side, the Courthouse Grounds. And they were open for breakfast and lunch and closed in the afternoon. I do afternoon tea. It's like, well, this is kind of, you know, this will work. And the guys there were absolutely brilliant and very open to the whole idea of bringing afternoon tea to Danville. And we ran an afternoon tea service a couple of days a week for about 6 months before I got itchy feet and wanted my own place. Hence, we moved out up here to Carmel.
We've been talking with Tina Jessen of Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen. For more information, go to tinastraditional.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from the best chocolate in town, purveyors of handmade chocolates and unique desserts located on Mass Ave. Local baker Gwendolyn Rogers spent more than 2.5 years building her baking business and getting her new cake bake shop open in Broad Ripple. It's been a heck of an experience, one that's included movies and even baking her signature chocolate cake for Elton John.
Because it was in the little house, I maintained the exterior. I didn't want to take all the charm of it away. So the whole front, which I have to show you, just because it's so sweet. This whole front fence is the original fence. So we took it off. We built like this really nice little brick thing that it could sit on, and then we power coated it and put it back. So that gate's the original gate. These are the original handrails. And the original part of the house goes from the French doors forward. So we kept that structure. And then the back of it's new.
When you first walked in, did you see the potential?
Oh, yeah.
Did you really?
I saw it from the street. When I met with Charlie Mong, he said, you know, what are you looking for? And when I met Charlie, I had already looked at 4 or 5 other places. I had other people approach me saying that I want to buy a building. Would you want to put your cake store there? And I went and looked at all those other properties, and nothing felt right. And I actually I got as far as laying out my kitchen on that strip mall next door, and I actually taped out the kitchen equipment on the floor. I mean, I was close. I was about ready to sign the lease with Kurt Mart, who owns that building.
Sure.
And then I met Charlie, and he said, well, you know, what are you looking for? I said, I really want an old house, and I want to remodel it and turn it into a bakery. And he said, well, come with me. And we walked down the street. He said, what do you think of that house? I said, that's it. It's perfect. I was like, really? He said, yeah. You like it? I said, yeah, I love it.
Right?
It's taken a really long time. It took us almost a whole year just to get all the permits. But, of course, the whole time during that, I was still baking, and I was still, you know, giving things away to all my friends and making cakes for parties. And, you know, it just kind of escalated over the last 2 years. So now I have this huge buildup just waiting for me to open.
you have so many likes on Facebook. You have a big social media presence already for a shop that is barely open.
I know, it's crazy.
So how did all that happen?
Well, I used to be an agent a long time ago, and I also helped my husband with his movie stuff that he does. And so I'm pretty good at that. I'm pretty good at it. And I knew that I had to cover all my bases. I knew I couldn't just have Facebook. I knew I had to have Twitter and Instagram, and I had to have a blog, and I had to have a website. And so, and I had to have a logo that was good enough. And when I first started, you know, I designed the logo myself, and it wasn't, I just didn't really feel, I didn't feel it. And my colors were a little bit different. I started with like a mint, like a very light mint color and a lavender color. But I knew I wanted it to be something that would make a statement and would be classy just by looking at the logo. And I think I accomplished that, which is good.
Now, tell me how the idea came about, what you were doing before this.
Well, before this, I was working with my husband. He's in the film business, and so I was working on a few movies with him. So we would, you know, set up producer meetings, and at one point we had a film called Glide, which is about rowing, and it was, we were going to shoot it in the UK. So we flew over to London, and we met with producers, and we got Tim Curry to star in it, and we had Rob Lowe wanted to play the lead, and so we got pretty far with it, and then for some reason, it all kind of fell apart. Like, I don't really know what happened, but there's so much involved in getting a film started that I was like, you know what? I don't really like doing this anymore because I put so much of myself into it. And it's what my husband loves, which is great. So he can go do that. And I thought, you know, what do I really love to do? And I love to cook. I love to be in my kitchen. I love food. So I made a list of what are my pros and cons? Like, if I'm going to do something, because my boys are getting older. You know, I have a 12, a 14, and a 17-year-old boys. And I thought, you know, everything I read is about food. Every magazine is a food magazine. Every book is about food. Every show I watch on television is about food. And every time I'm in my kitchen is when I'm the happiest. So
did you have
that's
any?
Kind of how
did,
I thought maybe I'll start something.
Did you have any training in the food industry other than, you know, other than interest?
No training whatsoever. But when all through my young adult life, I've worked in a restaurant my whole life. So I have done every single job that you can imagine. I've been the busboy. I used to clean the floors. I would take out the garbage. I was the prep cook. When I was 14 years old, I was the scone-making girl at a restaurant called Warm Springs in Sun Valley, Idaho. And I would get up early in the morning. I would ride my bike to work. This is I was in junior high. And I would make the scones, which is just dough that you would deep fry, and we would serve it with honey butter. So I would make the honey butter in the morning. And then another job I had in high school, I would ride my bike to a place called Lupe's Cantina, and I was the girl that made all the tortilla chips. And I think I was 16 when I had that job. So I've done everything. I've been a waitress for years. That's how I got through college. I've been a bartender. I've been a hostess. I mean, you name it, I've done it. The only thing I haven't done is own my own place.
So you know how hard the business can be, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But rewarding at the same time.
And so knowing all this, having, you know, all that experience, you went into it, and even knowing how hard it can be to be a success in this kind of business.
But I love it. And I think if you do something that you love, I think the rest of it will all come. Even I don't know what hard means. If I'm happy in the kitchen and making a cake, how hard can that be?
We've seen lots and lots of cupcake shops in the last probably 10 years. But this isn't what people might think of as a cupcake shop.
No.
This is kind of way beyond a cupcake shop, right?
I think so. I think, you know, we'll have cupcakes because that's what people like. It'll be a different version, I think, of what most people are used to. But it's really more about the feeling when you walk in the door. It's the sound of the music. It's the smell that you get that's coming out of the kitchen. Everything is going to be homemade every day. It'll be the way you feel when you look at the, you know, the glimmer of the light coming through the light fixture. It's everything about this place. It's not just about the food. It's everything. It's an experience.
We've been talking with Gwendolyn Rogers of Broad Ripple's Cake Bake Shop. For more information, go to thecakebakeshop.com. With the whole shop local movement, local food fans have gotten to know the growers at the farmers markets and the farmers who raise local meat and poultry. But could you create a similar connection between Midwestern residents and salmon fishing families in Alaska? I talked with Nick Mink and Marsh Skeel of Sitka Salmon Shares recently about how they have managed to do just that.
We started the company 4 years ago with three small-scale fishermen, all of whom were searching for better markets and were searching for a connection at the end of their line, so to speak, right?
Sitka Salmon Shares president Nick Mink, an environmental food historian, author, and former Butler University Urban Sustainable Foods Fellow.
How the program works is it's very, very similar to a Wine of the Month club. People pay monthly or at the beginning of the season for a share of the harvest of a small-scale fisherman. So that's Sitka Salmon Shares. And over the course of the spring, summer, and fall, depending on how many months you sign up for, you get a box of individually portioned blast frozen fish delivered to your doorstep, much in the same way that you would get a box of produce from green bean delivery.
Now, Marsh, how is it? What do you think when you're fishing? I mean, is there a connection with the consumer here in the Midwest? It seems like a very, very long distance connection, you know, because we're probably more familiar with, you know, talking to our farmer at the farmer's market, asking, you know, how something was grown, what to do with it, that sort of thing. Do you still feel a connection with the market?
Oh, definitely. Whenever anybody's excited about the fish, and it really makes all the work you do to ensure that the fish is perfect, that they really appreciate it on the other end.
Fisherman Marsh Skeel, captain of the FV Loon and Sitka Salmon Shares Director of Fisheries.
I think it's important to see that total picture. I think while you're fishing, you can be busy and the weather's bad and you've got these fish to deal with. And there's lots of shortcuts you could take. But I think when you understand the end product, that it's whether someone likes Alaska seafood or your Sitka Salmon Shares fish, it's kind of like an audition for seafood, enjoying seafood for the rest of your life. And so I think it's very important to understand that every piece of fish has to be perfect, and it's a delicate ingredient. So while I'm catching salmon, I'm thinking about that other end. I think it's really important to kind of know the whole food chain and know where your fish is going to be going, so you have that kind of accountability as well. And I take that very seriously.
Yeah, you're catching the fish in a particular manner, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is all spelled out and figured out so that the consumer knows, you know, what you're doing. Tell me just a little bit about how Sitka Salmon Shares is different in that respect.
Well, I troll for my salmon, so that's catching them by individual hook and line. So just the nature of the trolling. It sounds like trawling, but trolling is different, like under a bridge, a monster, that's kind of what you can think of. So we're catching them by individual hook and line, so you have time to care for each fish. You're not, you know, piling up net loads of fish all at once. You have time to catch them individually, bleed them, clean them, you know, clean all the blood out of them, and put them directly into slush ice. So it's taking that fish, removing all blood and guts, and getting it directly into the chilled as quickly as possible, and then doing shorter trips. So it's you know, your fish is going to have certain, it's going to break down over time, even if it is cared for really well. So at 5 or 6 days, it's going to kind of, you know, get softer and be a little bit more fishy smell, and then at 11 or 12 days, it's going to be kind of almost to a point where it really gets, the quality really drops off. And so we do, you know, 2-3 day trips. So that fish is really well cared for. It hits the plant. It's flayed, vacuum sealed, and blast frozen. So you're sealing in that freshness. And then on the other end, I think the consumer really can tell when they open up that package. You're going to slice it open, and you're not going to smell fishiness. You know, you're going to smell like what that salmon smells. It's going to smell like the sea, and that's what your seafood should smell like.
What are the prices like? How does it compare in terms of price to some of the product that we might be more familiar with?
It's hard to compete against large scale wild caught or large scale farmed product, right? Those are commodity products, and you know, generally, anytime you see a fish in a grocery store in that $8 to $12 price point range, you are dealing with a large-scale fishery or a large-scale aquaculture operation. You know, our prices are very, very competitive, if not cheaper than your nicer fish markets or Whole Foods. And really, depending on the species, we're in between $14 a pound and about $23 a pound for our shares. With most kind of coming in into the $16 to $18 range, which when you go look for a nice piece of salmon at a health food store or a co-op or a nicer seafood market, that's about where you're going to come into. You know, we are totally dedicated to being very price competitive, and we're always looking for, you know, looking at what the competition is doing, although we see them not maybe as much as competition because we think Americans should be eating way more wild, domestically produced seafood. And but we're always we are right there with prices for a nicer wild product.
We've been talking with Nick Mink and Marsh Skeel of Sitka Salmon Shares. For more information and recipes, go to SitkaSalmonShares.com. As I've said before, here at Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are always looking for a little cooking inspiration. And that's the idea behind our regular Cook This segment. So for this next interview, I had picked up a bone-in pork chop at Kincaid's Meat Market in Indianapolis, and I headed to the Mass Ave Pizzology to see how chef owner Neil Brown cooks a pork chop.
You know, this is a sort of a robust meal, right? I don't think, when I think of like a pork chop, I don't think of, I mean, you could make this an appetizer for two people, but I think in terms of like a meal, I don't know. Today, I think I'm going to, because it's lunch, I think I'm going to do something probably a little bit lighter. And I'll probably just do a little bit of, we're going to roast it in the wood oven, of course, because we have access to a wood oven. Why wouldn't you? And so I'll probably roast it off really well in the wood oven, get some nice color on it. And I'll probably just do like a little salad with it just to lighten it up because it's meat. And meat, typically for me in the middle of the day, is... I mean, try not to eat a lot of meat in the middle of the day. And I think a lot of people are the same way. It kind of weighs you down. Your body has a little bit harder time digesting it. And so, so yeah, just to lighten it up a little bit. And so probably just roast it off, make a nice little salad with it.
What kind of flavors do you think about? Does it matter what time of year it is? Or like you said, what time of day it is?
Well, it definitely matters what time of day it is. What time of year, of course, would that, I mean, that weighs on the ingredients that you have to use. You know, if this were dinner time, I would be thinking about probably some squash with it at this time of year. I'd be thinking about maybe, you know, I would start to think more in terms of what to accompany with it. I don't work with spices a whole bunch. So my proteins tend to be pretty straightforward, salt and pepper. I don't use curry, you know, I don't curry things, and although I love curry, but I tend not to do that. I tend to just kind of try to let that really great product sort of just do its thing, right? So, the time of year is just going to dictate the accoutrement, right? I'll see what we have laying around, basically, but I don't want to do anything too heavy. That's the key here, because it's, you got this really beautiful piece of meat, and get great color on it, and you know, make it just super flavorful, and then just accompany it with a really nice little salad, and try and keep it really light. That would be my sort of goal for this thing. Because we're at Pizzology, I'm sort of, we've got Italian ingredients.
Oh, you have a certain palette that you're working with.
That's exactly right. We have a certain sort of, you know, cadre of ingredients, and that's what I will use. So that's kind of what I've been thinking of in terms of what this would be. And I guessed you were going to bring me a pork chop.
Okay, why
I had no idea. I don't know. It was a total guess. I was like, I don't know what she's going to bring.
I thought pork chop is too easy. Is it too easy?
It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy.
But it's something real that people would
now
actually
I just
cook.
Hope I don't mess this up. absolutely.
They would actually cook a pork chop.
Oh yeah, they should.
Why not?
If they're not, they're Yeah, they're crazy. I mean, this thing's beautiful, too. This is a gorgeous pork chop.
So there you go. You got a 12-ounce pork chop, and it kind of has a little bit
and
of
honestly,
nice
I mean, you know, for lunch, you could feed three people for lunch with this thing.
Oh, I know. I know.
But for dinner, you know, this... Not for me. I would want my own. But I mean, a couple people. You could feed, you know, two people with this pork chop for dinner.
How about the eye?
I was trying to decide if I've ever seen pork chop on one of your menus.
Yeah. We had pork chops at L'Explorateur. We did a pork chop very early on at Libertine, which we took off very quickly because the price point was too high. We didn't want to do it anymore. But yeah, I love them. It's been a long time since I got to cook with one.
So just salt?
Yeah, salt, and I'll get a pepper grinder here in a second, and I'll get some pepper on it too. But I'm kind of, you can see I'm pretty aggressively seasoning it because it's going to sit for a few. And I probably won't season it. Obviously, I won't season it again before it goes in the oven. Nobody's going to learn anything from just seasoning a pork chop, right? Maybe. It'll be delicious, though.
Well, it will.
I think I'm going to do maybe, I think just a little sort of accompaniment with it. I think I'm going to do burrata.
What's that?
Just do a little fresh-made burrata. So just stretch a little bit of mozzarella, put a little ricotta inside of it. Great with a salad, great with a few little slices of pork. Again, Italian palate, so it's kind of what I have. So we're going to set this off to the side. And I'm going to run and get... couple bowls. I'm going to get a pot of water on to stretch my burrata. Get some ricotta to stuff the burrata with, and then we'll be working on sauce too.
Okay.
I'm probably going to put pesto inside of the burrata so that when you break open the burrata, you'll have a little pesto and a little bit of the curd.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, so it'll go with that pork and the dressing and the salad too. So I'm just going to put the ricotta inside. I'm going to put a couple little dollops of the pesto inside so that when you break it all open, it gets all, like, lovey-lovey. While it's cooling, it affords us the time to sort of do this.
So now, how hot is that oven?
Right now, it's 730 degrees. If you take a pizza stone up slowly on a grill, you could achieve this very same effect.
I could recreate... this almost.
Yeah. You know? No, you could. You totally could. And you could get, you know, this great color on it.
It's looking beautiful though.
No, it looks great, yeah. When it's finished, we'll just take it out, we'll let it rest for probably 5 minutes or so. We'll slice it, have a little salad, a little burrata.
Looks beautiful. My god, it smells so good.
Yeah, the eye feels fantastic, so just gonna take a little arugula, of course, a little salt. A little pepper. So this thing should be somewhat ready. Oh yeah, you can see how the
Show me what you're looking at.
Well, there's a beautiful clear liquid coming up out of the surface of the meat.
Right.
That's a great sign. You can also, if you touch it, it's not so hot that you can't leave your finger on it. And coming out of a almost 800 degree oven, that's saying something. That means that the heat has gone into the center of the meat. And so the juices are starting to come out and it's starting to settle down a little bit. It could probably rest a little bit longer, but we're gonna go for it. So you can see, I did not indeed overcook it. Still got a nice sort of pink medium center, which I like. So you can see. Go ahead.
Beautiful. Oh my goodness.
Let's make sure it's okay before we compose the dish.
It's really, really good.
Right?
Wow. We've been talking with Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar. To see photos of the dish he created, go to eatdrinkindy.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible through support from Glazers, marketers of fine wines and spirits. Local chef Tony Hanslitz is well known in Indianapolis. You might recognize him from the Chef's Academy or the Farmers Markets where he sells his fresh pasta,
or from one of his former restaurants, or for the private dinners he prepares at Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market. In any case, I knew the chef would provide plenty of inspiration on what to prepare with a terrific piece of salmon.
Well, it's a fatty fish, so it can handle the grill, it can handle in the oven, it can handle high heat in a pan. Sometimes what I like to do with it is, that's why looking at the skin, sometimes I like leaving the skin on. Skinless, there's so many different things you can do. A couple times, I do is just leave the skin on and just cook one side. So it's crispy, well done, medium, and raw. And then I have to really go see what's in the cooler. So what, for me, what I would do first thing is to see what I have first, because the salmon's pretty, it's salmon. Not that you could do a lot with it, but for me, I want to see what can I do with it, and that to me would inspire the rest of the dish.
All right.
So what I'm going to do is go walk in the cooler and see what we have,
okay,
and then we'll go from there.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is take the fennel and shave the fennel with, I'll make supremes of the grapefruit and oranges and some shallots, and just squeeze the juice from the fruit, and then on the mandolin, shave the fennel really thin, and then that'll kind of be everything, the sauce, put a little bit of olive oil in it and some salt. And then I still got to think about an herb yet. I've been thinking about basil, but basil is so licorice-y like the fennel is. I don't know. Then I thought mint, and I'm like, I don't know. I'll figure it out.
So what were you thinking when you were looking in the walk-in to see what was available? Why did things catch your eye?
It was all about the grapefruit for me. So I really didn't want to do this unless I had grapefruit, because I just wanted that. I wanted that flavor of the grapefruit. So that really determined everything. Because you could make this out with oranges, but I need that because of the fish. I want something to cut the fat. So
okay,
it'll be perfect. And then what I'll do is, now that I've got the oranges supremes, and I'll squeeze the juice out. So we're getting nearly 100% yield. And that'll start to form our sauce.
Okay, so you have just a regular orange.
Just
right?
A regular orange, and should be a little grapefruit.
Now, what was it about the grapefruit that made
just
you
the
think
tartness,
about it?
I just like the flavor. It's not so sweet. I just want something with a little bit of a bite. And it lends itself, because the fennel is sweet and so is the orange, so we needed something to fight that. Now, I won't squeeze as much juice from, actually I may not squeeze any juice from the grapefruit, because it looks like, since we're not doing a bunch of portions, what I can do, because I don't want it to be offensive either.
You mean too tart?
Yeah, Yep, too tart. Because, again, we still want to taste the fennel, the grapefruit, the oranges, the salmon.
So you've got the oranges and the grapefruit and the shallots so
far. That's it.
Yep.
And then I'm going to get the mandolin, and we're going to shave the fennel. And what we'll just do is add the fronds. Just stay with what we got.
Now, are you thinking flavors? Are you thinking appearance? Are you thinking
everything? It's
of
all,
course. Right?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, well, just like we talked about the basil. This needs green. I need something green. But also, it just can't be green for the sake of being green. I'm not going to stick a rosemary sprig in it, and because it's Christmas time and Charlie Brown's Christmas tree is hanging out of my food. So, you know, I mean, I'm not going to hang a blueberry on it or something, you know. It just drives me crazy. That's just one that just, ugh. I've been taught, and the same thing we teach is, if it doesn't have a useful purpose, why would I... You know, that's why I say the basil would go well, but I mean, we're using fennel, so, and again, we have a good yield on it, so let's just use it. It's right here in front of us, and it'll give us the look we want. It's delicate enough, and it goes with the dish. What a thought.
So you're adding a little olive oil,
just
right?
A little. Mm-hmm. And since we're doing such a small amount, I don't want to. Okay. And that's really the sauce, the garnish, the side, everything, all in one. So now, if I'm going to skin this from this side because of where it's cut, normally I go from the tail to the head. But I want the least waste as possible. So I can try to get my knife under the start there. And then I move the skin.
Oh, that's very slick.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you seasoning it with?
Just salt and pepper. Very simple. not really trying to OD it. You know, I just want it nice and simple. What I always want to do is presentation side down first.
Oh, okay.
Because the pan is the hottest, so it's going to give me the best crust. And in the fish, normally... skin side up, and then you finish. So, but to keep it safer, I always tell them presentation side, just because. As you can see, it's starting to. I mean, this is pretty thin, so it's not going to take long. Just nice and simple. Got a little salad on the side, or just on top. If you don't like how the vinaigrette wilts the. Frond. I think putting them in it, I know it does wilt it and gives it a little different. I mean, you could take raw ingredients like this and then maybe toss a little olive oil on them or a little of the dressing and use it as a side without the citrus. So
there's probably half a dozen ingredients at the most here, right?
Shallots, fennel, orange, grapefruit, olive oil, salt, pepper, salmon. So eight, if you consider, I mean, that includes salt and pepper. Yeah. So
this is stuff, you know, I would have this at home.
Oh,
I could do it.
Yeah. I mean, you might have to stop by and pick up an orange, a grapefruit and some fennel.
Right. But that's at the grocery store. It's something I could do.
Oh, you know? Easily. Yeah. Well, yeah, we just did it here in 15 minutes from start to finish. So, and that was even running to go get the olive oil.
We've been talking with Chef Tony Hanslitz of the Chef's Academy and Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market. You can check out photos of the dish he prepared at eatdrinkindy.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio here on WFYI HD2 and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. I'd like to wish all of our listeners a very happy new year and thank you all for tuning in to Eat Drink Indiana Radio. I'd also like to thank our guests today, restaurateur Ed Rudisill, Tina Jessen of Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen, Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop, Nick Mink and Marsh Skeel of Sitka Salmon Shares, Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar, and Chef Tony Hanslitz of the Chef's Academy and Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market. And thanks to our producer, John Katzenberger, for helping to bring you E-Drink Indiana Radio.